Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is April 15th. I'm very pleased to be able to share with you my first conversation with Jay Dyer of jaysanalysis.com. Now, Jay is a highly sought-after podcast guest. He appears on, it seems like, two or three different shows a week to be interviewed about his research and about his work. And I was very honored that he wanted to have me as a guest on his show. Now, Jay, currently anyway, is best known for his book, Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Film. So if you liked Conspirathon Silver Screen Edition, you may also like Esoteric Hollywood. Just a description from Amazon, like no other book before it. This work delves into the deep, dark, and mysterious undertones hidden in Tinseltown's biggest films. Esoteric Hollywood is a game changer in an arena of tabloid-populated titles. After years of scholarly research, Jay Dyer has compiled his most read essays, combining philosophy, comparative religion, symbolism, and geopolitics, and their connections to film. Readers will watch movies with new eyes, able to decipher on their own as the secret meanings of cinema are unveiled. And I guess over the course of the last year, Jay got an offer to turn the contents of the book into a television show, which I believe is going to be called Hollywood Decoded, and it's going to be on Gaia TV. I'll be talking about all of this in more detail with Jay when he comes on School Sucks as a guest, probably in early May. Even though this conversation, which deals primarily with the history of government school in America, covers a lot of familiar ground, I thought it was worth posting in the podcast feed here because Jay's input on a lot of these subjects is really interesting. You're going to learn stuff today, stuff we haven't talked about yet on the show. And I also want to be respectful of the way Jay releases his content. This was a two-hour interview. The second hour, I thought, was even better than the first. But what Jay does to support his project at Jay's Analysis is he releases the first hour to everybody for free. Not a bad idea. And then the second hour is for supporters only. So if you support this show, either through the AV Club or Patreon, you will get to hear the second hour. And here's how you do it. If you are a patron, good news, just keep listening. After the end of the first hour, it'll roll right into the second part. And if you are not, the show will abruptly end, seemingly right in the middle of Jay asking me a very interesting question. So sorry about that, but that is something you can rectify by going to patreon.com/schoolsucks. And for those of you who support us through the AV Club, the whole two-hour show is up on the website behind the paywall. So if you pull this off the podcast feed and you decide you want to hear the second hour, I recommend, if you can, hitting stop and just switching to the other version. And if you're driving right now, no problem. Just be assured that it is on the website and available for you. By the way, during this conversation, Jay asked me if I've ever been accused of, you know, disinformation or having ulterior motives. And I tell him that one time I found my name in a blog that suggested I was a shapeshifter. So if you've never heard this story, that might be a little disorienting when you hear me talk about that in the show. So I just wanted to read you a couple paragraphs here, a couple entries. This is like a journal style thing. It's called Lujan's Blog for June 2012. 8 p.m. What the deal is that probably about every nuke cooling tower in the world has a bunch of shapeshifters living under it, channeling evil energies, spells into the tower. And the tower is designed to uptake this input from them. Now with the ETs gone from the Arkansas nuke area, the good or gone work my allies and I have been doing to the area is sucked up and broadcast instead. My allies are working on the other nuke plants now. Also, for years, I have been nailing the nuke via grid blasters. Part of that good energy is the ongoing grid blasting from my place. 8.05 p.m. Now, 13 shape-shifting Satanists here are trying to negate all of this positivity. No doubt there will be further attempts. And then here is a hyperlink, so let's click on it and see who he's talking about. Oh, it's a link to a Google map. Where are we going? It's coordinates. Arkansas Nuclear One. So the culprits, according to the author of this blog, are hanging out in or underneath power plants. Well, how do I come into this? I don't have anything to do with power plants. Next entry, 9:10 p.m., so third entry since 8 p.m. Another shapeshifter, Jonathan Turley, Another, Warren Jeffs. So, of course, are the guys who put him away. More shapeshifters being promoted by Ernest Hancock, CIA-tanist, so like a combination of CIA and Satanist, reptilian, who I mentioned on February 15th, John Bush and Catherine Bleich, Dan D'Amico, and Brett Vanat. The other people at Top Tier Academic Consulting are also a bunch of shifters. That's a tutoring company I used to be the vice president of. So, thought you should know about that. That's the blog that I reference. So anyway, yeah, let's get right into the first hour of my conversation with Jay. Again, if you are listening to the show on Patreon, don't worry, I've made it easy for you. You can just keep listening. And if you are an AV Club member, know that you can get the full two-hour version of the show on the website schoolsucksproject.com. Huge thanks to Jay Dyer for having me on his show, for his interest in this subject, and for a lively and challenging conversation. I look forward to working more with Jay in the future. Thanks for listening, everybody. My final conversation with Stephanie and Brian is coming up at the beginning of next week, and then we'll be moving into a short series on postmodernism. And next week, I'll also have some exciting announcements about the upcoming event with Thaddeus Russell this summer. And that's it for today. I will talk to you again soon. Take care. Save my life, I'm going down for the last time.
You're listening to Jay's Analysis. This is the introduction to the Jay's Analysis podcast. The only authoritative source for Jay's Analysis is Jay's Analysis. Film, philosophy, geopolitics, the esoteric, and much, much more. Satire and comedy, too. Now, added bonus for free. Welcome, you're listening to Jay's Analysis. I wanted to deal with a topic that we've not really covered in depth at Jay's Analysis, and that is the subject of public education. We've mentioned it. We've talked about the Frankfurt School. We've talked about these specified subjects in passing, but we haven't focused a specific episode on social engineering, public schooling, and why school sucks. And so I got Brett, and you'll have to forgive me because I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce your last name. Brett Vienna Wiener.
Brett Fuck, you Vienna. Nailed it. You're the first person to ever get it.
What is it?
It's
I know that was really dumb, but...
Vanat.
Vanat, okay. Now, yes, I know that it sounds that way, but it's written... Actually, it's written that way. So actually, I should have pronounced it correctly, but I figured I'd fuck it up. But so Brett is the host, of course, of the popular podcast School Sucks. And I was telling Brett a couple weeks ago that I think about 5 years ago, I was eating dog food out of soup cans, poor, and I was doing grad work and I was fed up. And I listened to some of his podcasts around that time. You were probably getting started back then. Was that?
Yeah.
And then, so it had a profound effect on me because I was like, yeah, this public schooling is something is way off here because I've spent all my life in this system and I've gotten here to the point of grad school. And I ended up butting heads with this dude who was like a big time UN socialist dude who's the head of the department. And if you don't go past his firewall, you know, he's like Gandalf on the bridge of Khazad-dûm and you shall not pass, you know what I mean?
Right.
You have to go through the rigmarole of passing the initiatory mysteries of globalism before they'll let you into the PhD level, which is what I was going for. And so I got really disillusioned and I almost came to blows with this dude and quit. And so your podcast, I think, helped point me in the right direction at, you know, looking at what the heck is wrong with our school system and maybe it just needs to be junked, but I'll let you go. What started you on School Sucks?
Well, you know, originally I started the show in 2009 and I was a teacher myself and I was just looking for an outlet. I taught for a number of years in a boarding school and then in a private day school And then I worked on the periphery of the public system for a number of years as a college consultant. So kind of getting into a whole other problem there, and standardized test tutor. And the way I've described it before is like one job after another, one role after another, from making observations and I guess, you know, being blessed with a fair amount of curiosity about what I'm doing and why, I would learn my way out of the job. I would learn my way out of enjoying doing whatever job I had. So ultimately, you know, I was working as a support for the school without knowing it. I had realized the problems with the public system. So I said, well, I'll work privately, and that's a solution. So I worked for one tutoring business and consulting business, and then I started my own in New Hampshire. But I still just felt like I was participating in the problem. I'm just telling kids they need to go to college as if it's the 13th grade.
Right.
And I'm just pushing them that way. So I started to lose satisfaction with that work as well. So I started the show just as kind of a journal, a kind of therapy almost, to be able to vent. And I really, at the time, you know, in retrospect, I wish I would have had another 10 years to put my thoughts together about a lot of these things, because I thought, just from the experience that I had had over the course of a decade, I thought I had everything pretty figured out. And the show has evolved into just a continual learning experience for me. So, you know, my presentation is I'm kind of an everyman. I'm an average guy. And, you know, I'm on this journey trying to figure out school and, you know, all the things that surround it and what real education actually is. And, you know, people can listen and come along with me on that journey and engage in their own journey.
That sounds good. If only it were true. Now, what were you really up to? Weren't you working at the CIA?
Oh, I wish.
Do you get accusations? Have you been called a shill and all that yet?
Yeah, there was somebody, I found my name on a blog. This was probably 6 years ago, and it was me and a bunch of other people in a circle I was running in the time. And there was some lizard talk thrown around. And I don't remember, was it, they didn't say lizard. I'm kind of conflating. They said shapeshifters.
Oh.
So I don't know if shapeshifters assumes lizard.
Right. Because you could just be a hologram. You could be like a holographic entity but not be a lizard, you know,
like sure.
Max Headroom. You could be like Max Headroom.
So I was definitely accused of being a shifter though.
Right. Well, I'm being stupid, but so the reason I asked that is that you've done well with your podcast, and you know, anytime things get successful, you kind of get these weird things happening.
Mm.
But so what happened when, so you got fed up? Did you already think as you were transitioning out of the establishment and tutoring and into what you do now, did you already have a clue of the public school system itself kind of being an indoctrination, you know, brainwashing MK Ultra style entity, or did you learn this later?
No, I was kind of learning it as I went. And I got a lot of excitement when I was in college, and I had some exposure to the new left ideas of history, revisionism, Howard Zinn, Chomsky.
Howard Zinn, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I got real high on this, I know something you don't know, everybody, you know, that kind of like, oh, I've been lied to all my life, but now I know the truth. And I found myself going just from one area of exploration to another. So like the next stop after, you know, turning into like a radical leftist Howard Zinn disciple, mm-hmm. was the conspiracy world. It was like 9/11 truth and coast to coast radio. And now I really know something you don't know, I said to everybody. That was a sufficient stopover, maybe for a couple of years. I found Richard Grove's work, a mutual friend of ours, and his 9/11 Synchronicity, a podcast. And I was really impressed with the way that he could put content together. And, you know, I started to think maybe this is something that I might like to do someday for myself. But I didn't know how to organize my thoughts, and I was very schooled. So I was just taking in all of this information, and I wasn't really making use of it. From there, I wound up in libertarianism. Mm-hmm. And that was even more, you know, moral superiority initially. I know lots of things you don't know now about politics. So that same kind of whatever that need is kept getting satisfied in one way or another. But along the way, I accidentally, when I was in grad school, I was working on a master's degree in educational leadership, which is to become like a public school principal ultimately. And I'm glad that didn't work out. I just was doing research for a project, and I stumbled across some articles about books by John Taylor Gatto. Mm. This was pre 9/11 truther phase for me. So I said, oh my God, there's a conspiracy about school. That's ridiculous. But in the back of my mind, like a seed was planted at that point. Like, yeah, of course you would use school if you wanted to control people. What better way? And that just kind of, sat there for a number of years until I revisited. I don't remember exactly how it happened off the top of my head, but revisiting Gatto's work many years later, and then really digging into his work when I ultimately started the podcast.
A good quote along those lines. This is Horace Mann, of course, one of the founding fathers of American education. He said, "The common school is the greatest discovery ever made by man. Let the common school be expanded to its capabilities. Let it be worked with the efficiency with which it is susceptible. 9/10 of the crimes in the penal code would therefore become obsolete. The long catalog of human ills would be abridged, and man would walk more safely by the day. I believe that the common school will be the new instrument for the advancement of the human race. I believe that without free public schooling, we would be shorn of its healing power." It is like a religion, Christianity itself. And the public schools, he says, it basically goes on to say that they're like a religion. They're like a cult, and that they're going to save man. And I've got a whole bevy of quotes of this nature. Do you agree? Do you think that there was this socialist conspiracy? And I believe it was, personally. Amongst these characters who, of course, had monopoly capitalist backing behind them, to create little socializing outposts?
I believe it was very socialist at phase two, which was like the first reformation of the public school system, which took place at the beginning of the 20th century through John Dewey. I think Mann was a committed, passionate, true believer. And would be very offended by the word conspiracy being ascribed to anything that he was doing. You know, I'm pretty sure that he, as Dewey and, you know, the pragmatists and the progressives later would think, they thought they were saving the world. And I think if you just look at Mann in the context of his time, you're in this period in American history where you're running out of slaves the institution of slavery is coming to an end. And, you know, you have all of these immigrants coming into the country. This is as the school system grows. Mann is working a little bit before that period, like in the 1840s and 1850s. But I think a lot of people could feel the sands shifting under their feet. And I think there was a lot of fear about the future of American society and, the dilution of culture. They thought the school was had the potential, at least, to be a homogenizing force, you know?
Right. Well, the reason I say that, and the reason that I do explicitly use the word conspiracy, is not because I believe that Horace Mann or John Dewey themselves were at the top of some pyramid, but rather that they were part of, or at least in Mann's case, he was a Unitarian Universalist, and that did influence his worldview, his philosophy, and he was, as I understand at least, a Freemason. And we know that Freemasonry was one of the key movers and shaker organizations behind the public school system. And so in my view, Freemasonry plays a role in basically being a whispering, spying entity. And it also serves a function it has for many centuries of promoting revolutions in foreign countries. And generally speaking, these are funded by foreign powers, foreign banks, British imperial power, whatever. But you see, I don't think that it's accidental that so many of these people were part of the lodge, and that's what informed their philosophy. So even if they weren't fully cognizant of the totality of the conspiracy, they were at least part of these sort of revolutionary organizations that do have the explicit goal of, you know, re-engineering and reorganizing society. And I think that what we learned by later inquiries, you know, like the Rees Committee and things like this, is that these big foundations have for a long time, you know, been interested in reorganizing society, mainly through education.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I have to admit that my knowledge is in that area of the Freemasonic influence on the public school system in the United States is undeveloped. It's something that I'll look into. I can zoom out a little bit and right. just agree with you in more general terms that, you know, there is really no simple story that I've ever found about the history of the development of public school. It's kind of all things to all people who want to control other people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, lots of different interest groups. You know, from the progressives to the industrialists to right. the man's crowd, right. they all vied for control at one point. And this continues right up to today with things like, you know, Goals 2000 and its follow up, No Child Left Behind, mm-hmm. and its follow up or rebranding as Common Core. And it goes all the way back to the beginning. So, yeah, there were groups of people who always understood what school was in potentia mm-hmm. and, you know, worked very hard to use it to shape the society that they wanted to bring about, for sure.
What's interesting is that they all seem to promote democracy. And I'm speaking of all of the early promoters of our public school system today in the period of the characters like G. Stanley Hall, John Dewey, Boyd Bode. And then you have this wealthy Elizabeth Peabody, who's interesting because she's kind of the godmother of kindergarten. Now we know, of course, that goes back to the Prussian socialist model of education. And that was imported here to the U.S. But what Peabody, and this is like, if you go to Memphis, if I recall, this is the same Peabody's, you know, they have this giant wealthy Peabody hotel where the ducks ride elevators. I'm not joking.
You can go. Oh, that's very cool. Excellent.
Yeah. But Mrs. Peabody said, quote, children understood leading in the promised millennium of peace on earth and goodwill among men will make mankind forget the babble of confusion, and they will enter into the mutual understanding of the Pentecost miracle through kindergarten. So what I noted in my article that I wrote, I guess about a year ago, was just that what fascinated me was so many of these people have messianic approaches to education. And they also tend to tout liberal democracy.
Absolutely.
Now, yeah. Now, so what I think is going on here is that, and I'm not saying that Elizabeth Peabody, even as a wealthy person, was like in on a super duper conspiracy. But I think if you look at somebody like Madame Blavatsky and her interest in Freemasonry, and she, and then you can also actually find Scottish Rite magazines from about 100 years ago that will talk about the New Age being brought about through public schools, is that you do have, and this is, by the way, why the UN has been such a big promoter of this stuff. It's always tied to democracy. It's always tied to supposed egalitarianism and the idea that you can socially condition man through J.B. Watson and Pavlovian type conditioning. So
sure.
Are you familiar with like the idea of the, I'm sure you are, but maybe you could flesh out from your perspective the idea of how it might be linked to operant conditioning.
It's subtle and it's consistent throughout the entire 15,000 hour experience. And the Skinnerian behaviorists definitely were very, very influential. Mm-hmm. This went through a couple of different phases, and I actually have a video about it. It's called The Scientific Management of America, mm-hmm. and it's based on the underground history of American education by John Taylor Gatto, but it's enhanced with you know, some footage. Gatto mentions three papers that, of course, nobody knows about, but were all basically behaviorist applications to the schools in the 1960s.
30-odd years later, between 1967 and 1974, teacher training in the United States was covertly revamped through coordinated efforts of a small number of these private foundations, along with select universities, global corporations, think tanks, and government agencies, all coordinated through the U.S. Office of Education and through key state education departments, like those in California, Texas, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and New York. Important milestones in the transformation were, number one, an extensive government exercise in futurology called Designing Education for the Future. Number two, the Behavioral Science Teacher Education Project. And number three, Benjamin Bloom's multi-volume Taxonomy of Educational Objectives, an enormous manual of over 1,000 pages, which in time impacted every school in America. While other documents exist, these are appropriate touchstones of the whole, serving to make clear the nature of the project underway. Take them one by one and savor each. Designing Education, produced by the Education Department, redefined the term education after the Prussian fashion as a means to achieve important economic and social goals of a national character. State education agencies would henceforth act as on-site federal enforcers, ensuring the compliance of local schools with central directives. Each state education department was assigned the task of becoming an agent of change and advised to lose its independent identity as well as its authority in order to form a partnership with the federal government. The second document, the gigantic Behavioral Science Teacher Education Project, outlined teaching reforms to be forced on the country after 1967. The document sets out clearly the intentions of its creators. Nothing less than impersonal manipulation through schooling of a future America in which few will be able to maintain control over their opinions. An America in which each individual receives at birth a multi-purpose identification number, which enables employers and other controllers to keep track of underlings and to expose them to direct or subliminal influence when necessary. Readers learned that chemical experimentation on minors would be normal procedure in this post-1967 world, a pointed foreshadowing of the massive Ritalin interventions which now accompany the practice of forced schooling. The Behavioral Science Teacher Education Project identified the future as one in which a small elite will control all important matters, one where participatory democracy will largely disappear. Children are made to see, through school experiences, that their classmates are so cruel and irresponsible, so inadequate to the task of self-discipline, and so ignorant, they need to be controlled and regulated for society's good. Under such a logical regime, school terror can only be regarded as good advertising. It is sobering to think of mass schooling as a vast demonstration project of human inadequacy, but that is at least one of its functions. Postmodern schooling, we are told, is to focus on pleasure cultivation and other attitudes and skills compatible with a non-work world. Thus, the socialization classroom of the century's beginning, itself a radical departure from schooling for mental and character development, can be seen to have evolved by 1967 into a full-scale laboratory for psychological experimentation. Third in the series of New Gospel texts was Bloom's Taxonomy. In his own words, a tool to classify the ways individuals are to act, think, or feel as the result of some unit of instruction. Using methods of behavioral psychology, children would learn proper thoughts, feelings, and actions, and have their improper attitudes, brought from home, remediated.
So once the schools were up and running, they can be refit or modified for, you know, the changing needs of social engineering. Mm-hmm. And that's where I see, I mean, obviously, yes, behaviorism goes back to the beginning of the 20th century, but the collision between the public schools in America, it seems to happen in the 1950s and the 1960s. And further, are you familiar with Peg Luksic? Does that name ring a bell?
I'm not.
Straight from VHS to YouTube video that you can find of this woman named Peg Luksic, who was on a school board in Pennsylvania, talking about the federal role of education. This was probably in the early 1990s. The title of the video is Who Controls Our Children? And she talks about this idea of remediation. This is often referred to as outcomes-based education. Mm-hmm. You heard that term?
Yeah.
there was a big dust up in the South, like maybe 5 years ago, where the news story was conservatives were mad because they wanted something called critical thinking taken out of the Texas curriculum. So, you know, everyone in the media goes, ha, 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 conservatives, aren't they cute? And what they were really protesting was critical thinking being used as a cover term for this outcomes-based education, which was really about remediation. Education is not about knowledge outcomes. It's about thought outcomes, orientation outcomes, how you feel.
It's about producing a product, you know, the cubicle worker.
Yeah, well, it's that. So there's a kind of subordination that and that goal of school goes back at least to the industrial age. Mm-hmm. But also it's about producing certain types of attitudes. And if you don't get those attitudes through standardized tests, and this is part of what Peg Luksic is warning people in the school district about in this video, the standardized test as a scientific tool to check to see if certain attitudes have been inculcated in students, right? So people think that these are, you know, aptitude tests, but they're really attitude tests. Is the school conditioning children with the right attitudes and, you know, larger orientation to the world that is preferable to scientific managers? It always gets more sophisticated, but that's always the story in one form or another back to the beginning.
Yes, there's the program in the UK or Scotland actually called GIRFEC. Are you familiar with that?
No, I've never heard of that.
That's interesting because this is the socialist program there to assign, I'm not joking, by the way, to assign a social worker for you your whole life. I don't know how exactly the numbers are supposed to match out. I guess maybe one social worker per 10 or 20 people, maybe something like this, but it's the most insane thing you've ever heard. The most, you know, like, the Soviet Empire on acid type thing, where it's like,
right,
everything that you do throughout your life, you're going to be subject to a social worker. And this begins, you know, from your earliest days, I guess, prior to kindergarten. I don't know. But I noticed when I was in California last summer that some of the places in some of the cities in California, which is, of course, always the revolutionary ground for the rest of the country, you know, the stuff that happens there filters out towards, yep, the middle there and in New York, towards the middle of the country. Mm. A couple decades later, I noticed that they were setting up, I'm not positive whether they were state funded or not, but they were like educational outlets, pre-kindergarten. I don't remember what the word they used was, but it was like pre-kindergarten or something.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So they're moving to even get it, you know, like, daycare is transitioning into some kind of like pre-kindergarten thing. And your child then, of course, spends basically their entire life in some other person's responsibility with them, you know, brainwashing them. So what I'm getting at is just that I think that you start to see that these are sort of global patterns where they're really trying to push these things, not just in the U.S., but, you know, across the board in other countries even.
Well, it's interesting, yeah, especially in some of these.
Lifelong learning, you see, because that's what the GIRFEC program is going to be. Is you don't reach a point where you're done with this gigantic monstrosity of the Leviathan of the state. You are supposed to stay within the system your entire life.
Well, yeah, I think, and the sooner you can start, the better. And as you, you know, look at the broader picture of that, especially in these more socialist countries, like how useful it is to get kids into the schools sooner, because then mom can go to work. And, you know, because what do you need a family for? You know, the state's going to take care of that. So you see that these pieces kind of work together in that way. This has been pretty controversial, but, you know, out here where I am in New England, like the whole pre-K thing, mm-hmm, it's pretty standard. It's not public in a lot of places, but, you know, the reality is that, you know, parents go to work and one parent can't stay home to raise a child in those early and very formative years. So they either go to some kind of daycare or some kind of pre-K program. And yeah, I think these people, again, especially in the more socialist countries or the more collectivistic societies, would say, that's great. We just get the children sooner, and that should be a public system. And they probably are. I mean, you know, in a lot of the Scandinavian countries that American progressives are always, you know, so excited about, those are government funded projects. So, you know, get kids away from the family, and that promotes egalitarianism because, you know, families, a family could be anything, you know, and somebody could start life 20 steps ahead, and that's not fair. So let's just standardize everybody, homogenize everybody through state schools.
So let's get into more of the educational methodology. This is what you know about. This is your, I would assume, your area of expertise, so to speak.
Sure.
What has been the major alteration? So, you know, if we think back to, you know, the basic fields that everybody studies of reading, writing, arithmetic, and, you know, you had your grammar and I don't guess anybody learns logic anymore until you get to, like, you know, unless you're studying philosophy at a you know, undergraduate level, you're probably not taking logic. What was the, can you point to the shifts? Like, what were the big changes? And are the whispers and stories that we hear about Obamacare, or excuse me, Common Core, are they that bad?
Well, I mean, to start with the last part of that question, Common Core is probably the most blatant. The managerial class or corporations have been able to, at least since the foundation of the U.S. Federal Department of Education in the late 70s and its growth throughout the 1980s, they've been able to order up, you know, what they need the schools to produce. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're more than happy to have taxpayers pay for the training of a labor force. So it became very apparent in this last phase, and this kind of goes from, again, Goals 2000 to No Child Left Behind to Common Core.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure where it will go next, but in the Common Core phase, it was very clear, because people were sending me screenshots of or pictures like, here's my kid's homework, here's how my kid is learning math. And it is preparing students to basically work in a service economy, to be almost completely intellectually helpless. With that lack of, you know, critical thinking, there's great advantages as far as a kind of cultural conditioning that most people will accept fairly passively. And I think we've probably seen that become more apparent just in the last 10 or even maybe just in the last 5 years. The establishment of the Federal Department of Education was a big step in that direction for basically allowing outside interests to shape the output of the schools. But I'm trying to trace back through the 20th century, mm-hmm. because if you do look at materials that public school students were given in, say, the 1890s,
right.
Most of it is work that college students could not do today. And I am sorry, I'm kind of pausing here as I'm trying to map that progression a little bit better. But it's tough because obviously the schools were a branch of industry originally. So you don't think that they would want to be producing like highly creative and curious critical thinkers. You know, I mean, the setup for the schools was to produce industrial workers. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that in a pre-knowledge economy, right, we're talking about an industrial economy, people were learning at a much higher level and being challenged in ways at a middle school age that they're not challenged at a college age today. I mean, there certainly are de-evolutionary steps along the way that get us up to today, mm-hmm. but it didn't really start, you know, trying to produce. It's a couple of quotes come to mind in Wilson's age. So, you know, we're going back to the 1910s. We want one class of people to have a liberal education. And we want another class. I'm sorry, I'm paraphrasing a bit here. But he said, we want another class, a very much larger class of necessity, to fit themselves to perform specific, difficult manual tasks. And there's echoes in that of a Rockefeller Education Board quote or statement, where the gist of the statement is basically, look, we have enough philosophers and poets and scientists. Like that's a small fraction of the workforce. And those people, those rare people, those special people, they'll always exist. And, you know, us in the upper classes or the those who look down at everybody else, we'll always be producing more of them. You know, that lineage will continue. So those things will always be staffed. We've got this other problem where we have millions of nitwits that we need control. You know, and at the end of that quote was, we want to teach children to do certain simple things in a perfect way that their parents are currently doing in an imperfect way, you know? Mm-hmm. So from the beginning, you know, you don't have, you know, if you tested like, or graphed educational competency from the output of the schools, you don't have like a sharp drop off or even like a noticeable decline over time. Like it's bad from the beginning.
Yeah.
It was conceived as a branch of industry and a tool of governance. And, you know, neither of those goals suggests that you're going to be producing free-minded, entrepreneurial types of thinkers.
Yeah, and I think that there's consistent documentation of that when you come even a few decades further from the period that you're talking about, when you get into the 50s. And as I mentioned, you have the Reese Committee looking into the influence of the tax-exempt foundations, and you have the Dodd report,
and
the discussion states that the Ford, Rockefeller, and Carnegie endowments were funding Columbia, Harvard, Chicago, University of California, et cetera, explicitly, quote, to promote oligarchical collectivism. So what's interesting, the reason I bring that up is that that's the same methodology and ideology of decades earlier, the people in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900, 1910, you know, the Deweys, the Manns, the Bodes, the Barnards, the Carters, not Jimmy Carter, who were all saying the same thing: socialistic collectivism, democratic collectivism, right? And by the 50s, the committee is like, hey, wait a minute, all this collectivism is being funded by these oligarchic billionaire families. Something is off here.
And the move was always towards more globalism. I remember one of the findings from the Reese Committee was something like, we want to make sure that people in America, you know, these nationalistic, yes, not that I'm a huge fan of nationalism, but these individualistic and, you know, nationalistic people are never able to return to their pre-World War I mentality. We can't go back to that. We now have to have this, you know, global vision, and they all have to basically absorb that global vision as well. So this is, you know, I mean, most of my talk about the Reese Committee actually probably came in shows that had some kind of British angle, because, you know, that sort of the reunification project was a big part of that story as well. But yeah, I mean, it affected the schools. It affected, again, back to the attitudes being shaped in the schools. It's interesting, you know, sorry to tangent here for a minute, but we don't spend a lot of time on my show talking about school anymore. I did in the beginning.
Oh, now it's all fart jokes and toilet flush.
Right.
Now it's all Bane impersonations into a cup.
One day we'll just have to do a show. I'd like to do this with you, of just all voices. I think that would be terrific.
Gulp down all of this water so that I could rip off your Bane cup impersonation that you do. If you haven't seen Brett do it, it's funny. You have to subscribe, I guess, to Tragedy and Hope, and you see the secret Tragedy and Hope videos, and Brett gets the cup out, and he talks into the cup just like Bane.
Oh, School Sucks podcast is my YouTube channel, and there's a video of it's called Trump rips off his inauguration speech from Bane, okay. But where did Bane get it? It's just a quick a 2-minute video people can find if they want to see that for free. Yeah, so in the beginning, it was all, you know, schools this, school that. But eventually, you know, I wanted the show to be constructive. So I said, well, enough talking about school, right? I mean, this is one of the most important parts of the School Sucks project, is making the distinction between school and education. School is social engineering. You know, it's overseen by strangers to produce a kind of social efficiency in a dependable order for whoever happens to be in power and whoever happens to be able to use it. You know, education is self-directed. Hopefully it's lifelong. It's a pursuit of knowledge and understanding and wisdom. And those are very different things. And I feel like, you know, a lot of times when we're critical of the public school, we get sucked into this. And I think this is useful for maybe people in your audience who might want to, you know, share information about the problems with the schools. We get sucked into this, like, you know, how would kids be educated kind of conversation, which is like, well, they're not being educated now.
Right.
If somebody had a, you know, a plate in front of them with a stack of Wonder Bread and a mound of sugar, and I took it away from them, and they said, well, how will I be nourished? You know, it's the same kind of idea.
Right. Well, you mean there's fluoride in the public drink water? How would we drink water? It's really stupid. Yeah.
So the point that I'm trying to make is, and I also know that you've been critical of the libertarian philosophy as well. And I mean, I see myself as a libertarian, but I don't see that as like a society wide project. I see that as an individual project. You know, I'm trying to live as free as I can in an unfree world. And that freedom breaks out in it, because freedom is a very kind of nebulous word.
Right.
It breaks out to mean different things across, you know, a variety of different categories. I mean, obviously, the general idea is that you're free of coercion, that you're making your own decisions, that you're following your volition. But what is freedom in health? What is freedom in thought? What is freedom in education? What is freedom in vocation? And I think that that's something that has to be built from the individual up. And I think this is a pretty significant distinction between just sort of general political right and left as they're applied in the United States. The right, and you know, I know there's this is also true of a lot of like the religious right. Uh-huh. There's an effort to perfect the individual, right? That starts with the individual.
Sure.
Well, on the left, it's an effort to perfect society.
Yeah.
And the individual is often, unfortunately, a casualty of that, right? So, sure. So I didn't realize how stuck in this mindset I was, just because of an apathetic, you know, public school graduate mind that I was in my early 20s, or when I found libertarianism in my, you know, late 20s. I have this show that's supposed to be about the wonders of pursuing education, and I name it School Sucks, which evidences that I'm kind of stuck in that left-wing mindset. I'm going after something that's institutional and inaccessible, something that minimizes my own power by focusing on this thing that I'm probably never going to be able to do anything about in my life, mm-hmm. instead of saying, you know, the individual pursuit of education is a wonderful thing. It's not as good of a name for a show, but that's the idea. I mean, that's right. Really what we're trying to present here. So, you know, I want to come at it from that way, but the approach of the scientific managers has always been from the top down. You know, the idea of perfecting the individual from the bottom up, that's always been a kind of liability.
Well, on that note, what do you think about scientism? Because one of the reasons that I kind of go the route I do and why I'm critical of libertarianism is because it's often connected with the notion of, in the realm of philosophy, what we term atomism. And so the atomistic individual, right, who's conceived of as a unit, whether a unit of commodity or a unit of a government tabulation, we would say doesn't really matter, because the root problem is atomism. That is that the individual can conceive of a worldview or of his meaning or who he is as an individual. And I think that's the key criticism that I would make, or what I'm trying to get across when I debate someone on that topic or disagree with them is not that what you're saying about the existing system is wrong, because I think it's always almost 99% of the time correct. What you're saying about government, what you're saying about socialism, what you're saying about this, that, and the other, taxation. So, for example, in monarchies, traditionally, like a monarchy would have less taxation than we have in our supposed democratic republic. Now, I'm not saying that proves monarchy. I'm just saying, how could that even be the case, you know, given the absurdity of our present system?
Sure.
So you might want to say, well, yeah, but I think that if we had no government, it would be better. We don't have to go into a debate on the state or anything like that. But my question is even more fundamental in that regard. It's just simply, when we speak of freedom, and liberty, which I'm a big fan of, and that's why I find a lot of common ground with libertarians, is because the critical approach that you're taking, what you're saying is wrong. Again, I agree with, but I just don't think that there's such a thing as liberty or freedom that exists outside of a philosophy that is, in some sense, a tradition that gives meaning to what a person is. So liberty or freedom, I think, has to presuppose the notion of personhood, that there's some self that has some sort of dignity or worth, or that is the unit that you're talking about that is able to choose and make decisions, right? So, for example, if I was a libertarian and, say, a materialist, and mm-hmm. I believe that, like, maybe I got into libertarianism, but I was a big fan of, like, Dawkins or Lawrence Krauss or Hitchens or one of these characters, I don't see how one could really talk about the freedom of the individual or the individual having any worth whatsoever, given the fact that I'm also adhering to, like, materialism as a reductionist scientism type position. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, okay, so maybe I misunderstand. I mean, first of all, like, just to go back to something you said earlier, if anyone is arguing that they can build some conception of self or meaning of the, you know, personal meaning in the world in a vacuum, I would completely disagree with that. Obviously, I'm influenced by the family that I came from and the culture that I grew up in. And, you know, I think initially when people, or for me anyway, I guess I can only speak for myself, when this philosophy was new, especially for me, you know, transferring to libertarianism from this sort of hyper-skeptical left, it was very easy to turn my nose up at everything. You know, it's kind of like these are two political belief systems that come packaged with, if you want them, if you want to wield them as weapons, a kind of moral superiority, you know, the left especially, but libertarianism, you can see a lot of this there too. You kind of reject all of these things. You're skeptical of culture. I started to get creeped out by how, the more I learned about postmodernism, the more of Marx I would see in some of this stuff. And I really had to wrestle with that. And I think that's an ongoing struggle for a lot of people, is, you know, understanding myself in a larger context.
What I was saying was that this point that, for example, Quigley makes the argument early on in Tragedy and Hope, say the first 100 or 200 pages, he talks about what I call banker strategy beta. And this is the funding of revolutionary movements. And the gold standard back, you know, in the 16, 1700s. So when we think about scientific revolution and we think about French Revolution and its counterpart, the American Revolution, even according to someone like Quigley, he admits that those were shifts at the behest of the money power out of the older notions of what made up a society. So you had, prior to that, monarchies. And then you have this shift into the supposed righteousness of the Democratic Republic. And that's what begins to spread. You know, you have all these revolutions throughout that period. You have the French Revolution, Napoleonic Revolution, and most of the countries in the world experience these revolutions. And the point of that is just to say that my view is that both the more right-wing revolution of what are called Girondins, and this would be like a Jeffersonian type thought, who believed in private property and things like this, or a left-wing revolution, which would be the Jacobins. These would be more communist or Adam Weishaupt type, you know, right, radical Marxists. These are two branches of the revolution from that time period on. And even Quigley says this, as well as many other historians who will talk about the French Revolution. And so what I'm getting at is just that I don't see how the libertarian, this is just my criticism of libertarianism. I wasn't planning to get into this, but you brought it up. So
yeah, sure.
The libertarian ideology, Adam Smith, David Ricardo, all this kind of stuff comes out of that right-wing revolution from this period. And it's all part of the same dog and pony show, in my view, insofar as, on the one hand, you're forced to choose between, like, individualism or collectivism. Now that does not mean I'm saying that everything that the libertarian says is wrong, or that I agree with a lot of what the Marxists say. I'm not interested in Marxism at all. I think it's terrible. But yeah, I'm also not interested in atomistic individualism. And that is what is sort of the presupposition of the libertarian ethos. You know, whether you look at Ayn Rand or whether you go back to, you know, Adam Smith or whoever you're looking at in these characters, you have the idea that, is it going to be the Übermensch of the individual, or is it going to be the new man of the collective Borg, right?
Right.
Like, you know, is it going to be are we going to listen to Che Guevara, or are we going to listen to Ayn Rand?
Yeah, that's interesting, because I would be very critical of Ayn Rand as somebody who is creating these very flat protagonists to be these sort of embodiments of her philosophy, which I think has a lot of noble ideas in it, especially as a response to maybe being exposed to the Russian Revolution and, you know, that Marxism on steroids. And, you know, maybe Rand's approach was a little, I value her work very much, but I think maybe considering where she came from, what she saw, the sort of Dagny Taggarts that she creates are an overcorrection, you know, excited response.
Well, I was just using her as example, but I mean, you pick somebody from Von Mises Institute or pick whoever, you know, Ron Paul, whoever the hero libertarian is. I guess I just don't see how it's not still part of the, maybe not as bad of a dialectic of, you know, American modern left-right GOP stuff. But, in my view, it's just a dialectic that's, you know, like 100 years older or 200 years older. You know, we go back to the French Revolution, and the whole notion of right and left, communist versus individual, comes out of that French revolutionary model that they would meet at the, it was called the Vendée. It was this old tennis ball court, and the Girondins sat on the right side. And I think this was like Lafayette and the sort of noble characters who wanted to retain private property and wanted individual rights. And then on the left side of the tennis court, you had this is the provisional government they were setting up. You had the Jacobins. And so this is where we actually get the terms left and right in politics. And according to Quigley, this was bankers. It was Swiss and Jewish bankers that funded the French Revolution. Now, I'm not saying that everybody involved in the revolution was consciously aware of what they were doing, but rather that, you know, these revolutionary forces tend to be, again, just tools of the bigger powers, as Bolshevism was funded out of London and New York. So I just don't believe, for example, that you can divorce ideologies from history, or that you can divorce something like even logic from tradition. Because if you're going to say you're going to study a symbolic logic, it's really not possible to do that apart from understanding Aristotle and the Western and Greek tradition. Does that mean that I'm saying it's culturally relative? No, I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that the only way that we get access to this is still within the bounds of some quote tradition.
It did start to make me very suspicious. How did this impulse get so wrapped up in something that in many ways should respect certain traditions of the West, philosophic, economic, political, and want to improve upon them? It's interesting, though. You did raise a question. Do you see this dialectic, or this libertarian movement, is something that's capable of being, I don't know, weaponized by oligarchs the same way other revolutionary movements were?
Yes.
Okay. Because I'm wondering, I'm actually even, like, just in the last 5 days with this whole Syria Trump thing, I'm wondering, like, did that just happen? Right? Because that they sucked in a lot of people from the libertarian movement to support of Trump, to basically just, you know, throw all their weight and emotion and energy behind what, you know, I mean, it's too early to tell, but what easily could become, you know, the next neocon puppet, basically.
Right. And I think that he is already moving in that direction. And I was starting to note little bits of caving in here and there. You know, when I wrote an article, I was calling him the postmodern president. In league with that Federalist article. That's the reason I was supporting it, is not because I think that the American government is necessarily, quote, legitimate, or, I mean, it's really just a matter of power and force. It's a very will to power type situation.
Yeah.
Legitimacy, in quote unquote, in the state is a very complex, different topic. But I just thought, look, it's so bad, maybe this wacky, goofy character will do some good. And so, yeah, I did provisionally support Trump. And then I always said, of course, all along the last several months that, you know, anytime he does something I disagree with, I mean, it's not like my show has any influence anyway. It's not like I'm going to change policy. So it's not that big of a deal. But I said I would obviously disagree with him. I don't care anything about neoconservatism. I think it's ridiculous. But sure. Yes, neoconservatism is just dressed up Trotskyism and Bolshevism. And that's a flavor of revolutionary thought. And in the same way, if you look at the history of the, for example, the Libertarian Party, I'm not accusing you of this or trying to implicate you. I don't know what your affiliations are politically, but just through my own research of the Libertarian Party, I think it's suspicious that you have a lot of these CIA characters that are a part of it. That is circumstantial evidence. It doesn't prove anything per se, but I think that anytime you get all these, quote, former CIA people involved in the party and running it and being their presidential nominee and all this kind of stuff, I'm already suspicious of it. When you look at David Rockefeller writing his master's thesis on von Hayek, and, you know, he was actually a big proponent of that school of Austrian school of economics for a long time. I don't know if he grew out of that and grew into his monopoly oligarchic view, or if he believed his monopoly oligarchic view the whole time. I just see it as a situation where I don't really see why one wouldn't adopt a David Rockefeller worldview if you were a libertarian. I mean, why not? In other words, you know, like you were criticizing Ayn Rand, you know, why not? If you're John Galt, like, what would keep you from actively involving in buying off the state? I mean, there's nothing morally. You can talk about morals, but says who gives a shit? Like, why would I be bound by this principle of, you know, oh, it's immoral to, if I'm John Galt, to buy off the state and have the state enforce laws that give my company a monopoly? Like, why wouldn't you do that? You've been listening to the first half of my interview with Brett Vanat of the School Sucks podcast. If you want to hear the full talk, go ahead and go to jaysanalysis.com and subscribe for $4.95 a month for $60 a year. You can also purchase my book, Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Film, the bestseller with 65-star reviews across markets. Also, check out the School Sucks Project, which is Brett's work. You can find all kinds of information there. And thank you for listening. You're listening to Jay's Analysis. This is the introduction to the Jay's Analysis podcast. The only authoritative source for Jay's Analysis is Jay's Analysis. Film, philosophy, geopolitics, the esoteric, and much, much more. Satire and comedy, too. Now, added bonus for free. We'll be right back.